Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very pleased to have back on the show one of our favorite guests, May Barenbaum, is here. She's an entomologist, a scientist who studies insects, and as a matter of fact, she is head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And usually, at least, you know, 2-3 times during the year, particularly during the warmer times of the year, she is here and we talk about insects. The very first thing I always say on these programs is this. If you have extermination questions, you must save that for another day. We have a guy for that. A very nice man, Phil Nixon, who probably, you know, gets a bad rap because we sometimes refer to him as the kill the bugs guy. Although, I will say in Phil's defense that he's very much for coexistence if that's possible. However, that's his sort of his special thing. When May is here, we do something very different, and here we try to enjoy, appreciate insects for their many varied forms and the ways that they go about living their lives. So if you have questions about insects that don't have to deal with extermination, if there's a particular insect that you have seen and you're curious about and you're not sure what it is, if you can give us the description, she may, based on that, be able to tell you what it is. Any and all sort of insect questions are certainly welcome. That is, as I say, short of extermination. She is, by the way, author of a number of books, if you're interested in doing some reading about insects, including 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, which I think, was that your first book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also the increasingly famous and popular 99 More, Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. Also, the most recent one is Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. And that's a collection of columns that she did mostly. This was kind of for entomological journals and stuff like that.
Well, it was, they're all, well, most of them were written for the magazine called American Entomologist, which does go to entomologists just as a consequence of paying dues in the Entomological Society of America. But additional essays were written to sort of broaden the base. So it's not, you don't have to be an entomologist. At least I'm told you don't have to be an entomologist.
Well, I think that's true with most of your books and also the Bugs in the System, which deals with various subjects showing how insects get involved in human beings and in their lives. And I think they're all really very accessible. So if people are interested, particularly the first two that I mentioned, if you have kids who are interested in insects, that might be a good thing for you to look at. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-WILL or 9455 and toll free 800-222-WILL. Well, we're very pleased to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. We have a caller ready to go, so we'll get right to them in Belgium. And in Illinois, not in Europe. Here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask if Ms. Barenbaum had made the same observation as I have, in that there seems to be a lot of butterflies this year.
Funny you should say that. As we were walking in the studio, I said to David Inge, I'll bet someone asked me about the painted ladies. And that's what they are. There is an enormous influx of painted ladies here. They're sort of a pinkish, brownish butterfly. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, I've been seeing just all kinds, ma'am, of every sort.
Well, what I see around here is just hundreds upon hundreds of this one particular species, which is actually, it's a migratory species. So what we might be seeing is a movement. These guys periodically build up to huge population sizes and then just overflow and move. So at least some of what you're seeing is the painted lady butterfly.
I've been noticing lots of different types, but I don't know the names of any of them except the monarch, of course.
Well, it seems to be a good monarch here, too, because I've seen quite a number of those butterflies as well.
Yes. The other something I'd like to bring up is in things we don't want to talk about, we talk about the Japanese beetle a lot. And it seems to me that years ago there was a bug that we had around here called the June bug. Now, it looked somewhat different from the Japanese beetle.
That's exactly right. The June bug is in the same family as the Japanese beetle, but it's in a different genus. It has sort of a different life history, too. The Japanese beetle is not native to this part of the world. It was introduced into actually New Jersey around 1916, probably clinging to the soil of nursery plants, and it's slowly been making its way across the country. I grew up actually in the Northeast, so I went in the early 60s, giving my age away here, one of my tasks at home was to collect the Japanese beetles off the rose bushes and the blueberry bushes and the grapevines, because they have a very, very broad host range.
Yeah.
But you're right. They as larvae, they're both C-shaped white grubs that live in the soil and eat grass roots.
Mm. Well, I've never seen the larvae phase. I've only seen the phase of
But life. You got to know they're there to have the numbers of adults we have.
Oh, I'm sure there are. The last topic that I was wondering about, and does this other June bug still exist?
Oh, yeah, it's still around. It may be.
Very much, huh? Yeah.
Well, it may be having some competition problems from Japanese beetles, or it may just be the same numbers are around, but they're so overwhelmed by the numbers of Japanese beetles that they kind of lose all sense of proportion. So.
The last item, we have these little ladybug-looking things. I think they're called the Asian brown.
Multicolored ladybug, yeah.
No, we have a ladybug that exists here normally.
Uh-huh.
But there was another one that's just showing up a lot around that's really a pest.
It is an obnoxious pest.
Species, right?
It's a new introduced species, Harmonia axyritis. It's sort of a good guy gone bad, I guess. You know, ladybugs have such a great rep, and here's a ladybug that comes in and gobbles up not just pest aphids, but anything that's slower than it is.
Yes.
And then it actually even overwinters in houses, because where it's native, where it likes to overwinter, are sort of cracks and cliff faces. And here in central Illinois, we're a little short on cliff faces. So the closest thing it can find are buildings, and comes into buildings. It smells bad. It bites people. It's just out to completely ruin the reputation of ladybugs everywhere.
That was the question I was going to ask. It does bite, because
yep.
My wife says, that bug bit me. And I said, ladybugs don't bite. And obviously she was right.
Yeah, every year now I get calls from people who seem sort of not just injured but indignant as well. I got bitten by a ladybug. Is this possible? This guy, you know, this particular species knows no bounds. It's just it's a bad actor all around.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
thank
thanks.
You.
Tell us again what this ladybug looks like?
Well, the problem with describing the Asian multicolored ladybug is that it's multicolored. It comes in a range of background colors and a range of spot numbers. Hmm. Looks like about the only surefire way to recognize it is right behind the head of the ladybug is what's called a prothoracic shield. It kind of looks like a little scarf would be. And if it looks like it has kind of white fat parentheses, then odds are very good it's an Asian multicolored ladybug. And they're out now. They're abundant.
Okay.
And if it's, you know, clogging up your windows or aligning itself along the walls, odds are good that's a multicolored Asian ladybug, no matter what color it is.
All right. Very good. It seems to me that earlier this summer, I was seeing lots and lots of red admiral butterflies. And the only reason I know that's what it was is because you told me what it was, because I was seeing a lot of them in my yard. Are there particular conditions that are good for butterflies, or is it just that their populations, they go through cycles? There are years where there are lots of them and years where they're not, and it doesn't really have anything to do with things like, is it hot, is it a lot of rain, or that kind of thing?
Unfortunately, most butterflies aren't economically important enough to have had a lot of work done on population dynamics so that people know why some years there's a big population of red admirals, and other years maybe it's morning cloaks. But it's really, we have about 100 species of butterflies in North America. In Illinois, state of Illinois. Sorry, don't call. I know I misspoke there. Probably the best known is the monarch, Danaus plexippus. And even many aspects of the monarch's life cycle are still pretty much mysterious. If it's not economically important, people don't know a lot about it other than sort of anecdotally.
May Barenbaum is our guest this morning. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And every once in a while here we talk about insects. And again, let me stress, please, no extermination questions. We do that on another day. This is the Love the Bugs show. And if you have insect questions, you can call. The lines, however, at the moment are full. So if you did try to call, you'd get a busy signaling, so you'll have to wait until we talk with some other folks. Well, next we have someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello. I was just wondering if you could address the question of how insects survive in wintertime. I've always been curious about that, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Sure. Well, that's a... Oh, am I...
No,
you're...
Yeah, that's
here?
Yes,
okay.
That's the... Yeah.
There's... I'll probably imagine about as many different ways to survive the winter as there are in different insects. Some of them do what a lot of people do. They just head south. So there's a lot of species here in central Illinois that don't spend the winter here. They actually recolonize every year and die out when it gets cold. In fact, some of our more noxious pests might not be residents here in Illinois. They just fly up from parts south. There's other more hardy types that generally spend in a temperate zone like we have in Illinois, although it doesn't seem that temperate sometimes. A lot of insects pass the winter in a stage that's resistant to environmental unpleasantness. So it depends what life stage that is depends on the species. Some of them are eggs, some of them are pupae, some are actually adults. But what characterizes most overwintering phases is they enter a stage called diapause, which is like hibernation. Their physiology slows down to next to nothing. They don't move around. In some cases, antifreeze substances build up in their blood, and some species can even freeze almost solid. European corn borers can do that. Some species of midges can do that. Call them fridges instead of midges. But they acquire these antifreeze substances and just kind of slow down and don't eat and don't think about reproducing or don't move around until the weather warms up in the photoperiod, the length of daylight increases. So that's sort of the basic way, is through this period of physiological low-key lifestyle called diapause.
You know, last spring, I talked with a veterinarian who was here from New York, who came here to talk about, who was the person apparently who discovered West Nile virus in New York.
Tracy McNamara.
Yes. Uh-huh. It was interesting because I did a little bit of reading I did to try to prepare for the interview. One of the things that they were wondering about in New York the first year that they saw West Nile was, would the mosquitoes apparently who are carrying it over winter? And they found out that they did. And I think what they found was that, and maybe it wouldn't surprise you in a place like New York, there are enough places in the built environment that stay warm that the mosquitoes can
keep
going all year long.
That's the other way. I mean, household pests like cockroaches they're actually tropical in origin or African in origin. They don't have to worry about, they live in a subtropical environment as it is. If you live in a house, you don't have to worry about the winter. So
it seems like what we have done with heating spaces in the wintertime is that we've altered the environment and made a place that they can exist where in the past there wouldn't have been a warm place for them to sit out the winter.
Then again, there's always global warming, and people are worried about the implications on disease-carrying mosquitoes and other insects that were historically just sort of concerns for tropical places. But there's some worry that if global temperatures are rising, we might not be insulated here in Illinois.
Okay, let's go on. We'll go next to Charleston, line number two. Hello.
I'm a big gardener, and I was wanting to know if there's any type of information that would help a person to recognize beneficial insects and different ways to attract them.
Well, actually, the Natural History Survey, Illinois Natural History Survey here in Champaign-Urbana, has come out with a set of, I guess you could call them like flashcards. It's a little stack of cards that allows you to tell. I think they're called the good guys, and it's you can bring it out in the garden. They're laminated, and you can just sort of hold the cards up next to whatever is crawling on your vegetation and say, and at a glance, make a good guess as to whether it's a good guy or a bad guy. And these are available, I think, for a nominal amount from the Illinois Natural History Survey.
Okay.
And you can even look, since they're laminated, you can even check in the rain and see what's out in your garden.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, very good. To Southern Illinois for somebody else right here. Line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I recently, in the past 2 years, I've found over five of these things, and I was just curious what they are. I got a specimen in a jar, but he's about, I'd say, 3/4 of an inch or so roughly long. It looks like an ant. It's red and black. I think it's got three parts of a body, and it's like, I think the black is the middle piece. But, if you touch it, he makes this weird noise. I didn't know what it was. I was wondering if it might be a termite queen or what. I just didn't know.
Does it have antennae that you can see?
Yeah, and they're kind of fuzzy looking.
But they're not elbowed or bent?
Yeah, they are.
Okay, well, if they're elbowed, then what you have is an ant of some sort.
Is that right?
That's like that little sort of jaunty bend in the antenna is kind of an ant characteristic. Termites have straight antennae. There's something called a velvet ant, which is a hairy wasp that looks a lot like an ant that's wingless. But they don't have that bend in the antenna. So if you've got a...
He doesn't have any wings either.
Well, it could, what happens to... It's big enough that it could be either a worker of one of the species of Camponotus, one of the carpenter ants, and there's actually one species that's red, more red in color than black. We have the black carpenter ant up here. But if you're down south, it could be one of the other carpenter ants.
And he's fuzzy kind of looking?
No, they're not really fuzzy.
Like velvet. I mean,
it does look fuzzy?
Yeah, it's real hairy.
Well, it could well be a velvet ant then, which is not exactly a... It's a hymenopteran. It's in the same order as the ants, but it's in a different group. It's actually a wingless wasp.
Hmm.
And if you have a female, you should be very careful because their stings are incredibly painful.
Oh, yeah. I could see that it had a huge thorn sticking, jabbing
oh,
out.
Well, yeah. Stay away from that end, actually.
I will, but I wanted to find out what it was.
There's a species of... a velvet ant that lives in further south called the cow killer, which gives you an idea of how much punch that stinger can pack.
Wow.
So, and velvet ants typically are orange and black, and like the name says, velvety, hairy.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Oh, well, congratulations. Do you live in sort of sandy area, or is there sandy soil around? Or?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Here in McLeansboro, you know, and just outside of McLeansboro area of southern Illinois.
Well, they're more common down south than they are here, so that would be my guess.
I've seen 5 in 2 years. I don't know what that means, though. All right, thank you.
All right. Thanks. I think we've talked about that before, and you've cautioned people because apparently they're... they look, you know, sort of innocuous, and you might indeed think that they were an ant, and you might, you know, I don't know, if people are really moved to pick things like that up, but if you think that this might be a velvet ant, you really, don't do that, because you will definitely regret it. I don't think I've ever seen one, but I guess I've seen pictures of them. I have not seen an actual one in the flesh. And there it is. And, of course, it's a black and white illustration, so it doesn't quite...
But you see, that's not really an ant elbow. It's a bend in the antennae, but the elbow is just like your elbow.
It's not a 45-degree angle bend. There, it almost looks like a question mark that's been squashed just a little bit. Okay. All right. Very good. We keep going here. The next person we'll talk to is also Southern Illinois. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi. Could you tell me how to appreciate jiggers and... what they're all about and what they secrete that makes you itch, and if there's anything to help alleviate that?
Well, appreciating chiggers it stretches my limits, you know. They're not insects, first of all, so I don't feel morally responsible for making excuses for them, but they're more closely related to spiders. They're in the group, they're actually kind of mite. So their closest relatives are actually not spiders in the class Arachnida, which spiders belong to, but ticks. And like ticks, there are a lot of mites that are parasitic, and chiggers are the immature stages of a harvest mite. As an adult, it's actually not parasitic. And I guess if you want to appreciate them, you have to admire what a tough job they have. These tiny, tiny creatures have to find... warm-blooded, fast-moving hosts in which to sink their mouth parts. So that's one thing to admire, is that they tend to do is crawl up to the tips of grasses or other, you know, sort of tall vegetation, and just kind of blindly stick their little legs out and hope to grab something that walks by, like your jeans or something. And They are responsive to carbon dioxide. That's one way they can tell there's a living, breathing body passing by. That you know, most organisms breathe out carbon dioxide in pulses. So that's if you want to try to cut down on chiggers, you might try holding your breath if you walk through a chigger-infested area and walking next to someone who's breathing heavily. I don't think that's scientifically tested. But
how small are they?
They're pretty small. Well, let's see. I'm not good at estimating, but I would say an image, you know, a chigger would probably be about, you know, a millimeter, the limits of what you can see with your naked eye. They do get bigger as they molt and grow. And then as adults, they feed on sort of debris in wooded areas. They don't actually, they're not parasitic. What they do, they don't burrow under your skin. That's a common misconception about what chiggers do. I don't know if what they do is that much better. They basically dissolve your skin. they secrete these tissue-destroying substances that turns your skin into soupy pulp, and then they can sort of lap or suck that back in. Now, the problem with chiggers is all this takes a while for your body to recognize and react to. So by the time you itch, they've already done a lot of damage. And, you know, the sort of the classic solution of painting nail polish over where it itches can be too late. The chiggers might actually have already fed and dropped off by that point. In terms of getting rid of them or avoiding them, the standard insect repellents work for the most part against chiggers. Powdered sulfur is...
Put that on before, not after.
Yeah, if you're going to go walking through tall grass and the like, if you've been infested, you probably know they like tight places. They like belts and cuffs and the like. So it's kind of, if you're in an area with ticks and chiggers, you need those clothes to keep the ticks off. But if you wear those clothes, you're more likely to get infested with chiggers. So they've got us figured out. So. In terms of what they do, there are some species of chiggers that are actually vectors of diseases, but not around here. There's something called scrub typhus that's spread by a mite in Asia called the Tsutsugamushi mite, but we don't have those here. So here they're just mainly an incredibly itchy annoyance.
Do they secrete a substance similar to what a recluse spider would when that destroys your...
No, not. It's not sort of galloping necrotic. It basically dissolves the immediate area and, you know, breaks down the tissues there. But it's not like a brown recluse where you get extensive areas of tissue death and gangrene and ulceration, and that's really, really bad news. There's a hemolytic toxin, a toxin that's poisonous to red blood cells in the venom of the brown recluse. And chiggers don't actually suck blood. They really don't break down red blood cells. It's more skin cells they're breaking down.
I had a friend just this summer who got a brown recluse spider.
Ouch.
And she ignored it, and it spread from her armpit down to her wrist and black lines, and they finally had to cut it out and put stitches in to clean it up.
Well, she's lucky she didn't lose her arm, because there have been brown recluse bites that have led to amputations.
One doctor said it wasn't a recluse and finally went to another. It was awful.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's peculiar funny. I have gotten many calls over the years. No one ever sees these guys in the act. So oftentimes when there is sort of extensive tissue damage of that pattern, the immediate suspect is brown recluse. And I've been called by a number of lawyers and involved in lawsuits trying to establish responsibility for where and when an ostensible bite took place. But it's really hard without the body, you know, sort of habeas corpus kind of thing. Without the specimen, it's hard to say what caused it.
One more question on the chiggers again. Is there any kind of lotion or herb or like pennyroyal to rub on to repel them? Have you ever heard of that?
Really, the only one I know of that I know is effective in, like, really challenging conditions, like in the tropics, is elemental sulfur, just that yellow sulfur powder. But I expect some of the other insect repellent substances might work as well. I don't have any studies to cite.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We are at our midpoint. Our guest is May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, and this is one of those shows we do with her. We talk about insects, and again, we say, don't save your extermination questions because that's really not her special area. We do have somebody who does those shows with us because we know that there are times when, you know, you may act, when you cannot appreciate them, you just have to get rid of them. But on this show, it's kind of a different thing if you have questions about insects and their endless variety. You can give us a call, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have next an internet listener in Vienna, Austria. Hello.
Hi. I've been listening to you for quite a while, and I enjoy the shows immensely. Of course, I grew up in the area there and have always and went to the University of Illinois, so it's a little bit closer to my heart than just mere curiosity.
Sure.
I was going to ask your guest, Dr. Barenbaum, I have two questions for you. The first question is something that's always intrigued me. Are there any statistics on what, for instance, the overall biomass of all of the insects in the world is? I mean, they're everywhere, yet they're very small, but if you sort of totaled up there some biomass, they'd be pretty large. And I was just curious if there were any statistics like that.
Oh, yeah. This is sort of a pastime for a lot of entomologists to do these sorts of calculations. And in fact, I did write an essay about this very subject, which you may be able to find on the internet. I think it's posted at the National Academy of Sciences or National Academy Press, nap.edu, I think it is. The book I wrote, Buzzwords, has that essay in it. And nobody can exactly agree, but I always find them sort of amusing because they're, you know, always you have to express them in terms that people can comprehend. So kind of comparing them to the equivalent weight of humans encircling the globe 22 times. So, there are lots and lots of calculations about the total biomass of insects or how many offspring a particular pair of insects can produce. So, but at the moment, I didn't commit these numbers to memory because, frankly, I'm unconvinced of their value. I believe one estimate of the number of insects is 10 quintillion, which is one with a lot of zeros after it.
Right. Well, okay, but I was more not interested in as much in the number of insects.
But in the biomass.
The overall weight, you know.
Well, E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning insect biologist, has estimated that the sum total of ants alone, the biomass of ants, greatly exceeds the biomass of all humans. And that ants are just one family.
Yes.
So, and yeah, there are lots of numbers, and they're...
Well, you've some a website where you can look, and perhaps I can get some information there. And the other question I had for you is, I'm almost totally blind, and grew up right in East Central Illinois, where you know I was very much exposed to flies and mosquitoes and everything else. But the thing that's always interested me was, are you aware of sort of anybody that produces tactile models of these insects? Obviously, because even if you catch one and try to feel it, you know they're so small and of course, getting visual descriptions is fine, but to actually feel for myself what the, you know, their mouths feel like and their antennae and their wings, it would be very nice to perhaps purchase some of these models or go to a museum that has models that a person could touch. Do you know if anything like that exists?
You're not talking about life size, right? Because that would be...
They'd have to make them larger, of course.
Well, actually, I think you might be able to find those from Carolina Biological Supply. At least they used to have them. And our department has several, sort of 3 foot long, I don't know if you, from your, maybe nobody's as old as I am, but when I was growing up, the visible human, the visible horse, you know, these models that you could put together with all the various organs. Well, we have a few of those sort of enormously enlarged Three Mile Island kind of giant
right.
Beetles that you can feel and dismantle and see all the mouth parts because, you know, even if you have, you know, perfect vision, it's still very hard to see a lot of insect details. So,
oh, I understand.
Yeah. So you might try Carolina to see if they still carry these models.
It's called Carolina
Biological Supply. They have a website, and I expect it's probably something like www.carolina. Or, I don't know, but it shouldn't be hard to find. Ward's is another one that sells biological specimens. It's in Rochester, New York. And Carolina is in North Carolina, Burlington, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So those two biological supply companies, at least in the past, have had large models available.
And the last question I had, and then I don't want to take up too much of your time, let alone for the long-distance call, but when I was living in Illinois, every summer evening I would hear these locust type of things that would sing. Some people call them katydids, some people call them cicadas, but one group would start, and then all of a sudden another cornfield or a group of trees, the next group would pick up this song, and they would sing, and it was a very rhythmic type of sing-song type of thing. What kind of animal is that that sings that?
Well, there are two different animals that you mentioned that both sing around this time of year. The cicadas are actually sort of sap-sucking bugs, and they're the ones that kind of make this sort of kind of sound that goes up and then down in intensity. But the ones that look actually like grasshoppers are katydids, and they sing like this sort of katydid, katydidn't, katydid, hence the name. They're supposedly arguing with each other whether katydid or katydidn't, and that's where the name came from. And they, if you see them, they're about 3 inches long, and they're pale green, and they look just like a leaf. In fact, their scientific name, Pterophila, means wing leaf, because their wings look like leaves. And that's what they do during the day. You don't see them because they rest in the leaves, and at night they make their presence known with these calls.
Or do they just sort of hang out on the tree?
They can fly. If you disturb them, they'll fly away. And both of them make the noises to attract mates. I mean, that's the whole...
I see. And are they viewed as pests for farmers, or are they...
Not really.
Innocuous?
Cicadas, particularly the not the periodical cicadas that come out every 13 or 17 years, but the annual so-called dog day cicadas or harvest flies, mostly suck xylem sap. That's the sap that's... brings water and minerals from the roots up to the photosynthetic machinery of the trees. So they're not sort of tapping into the tree's food supply or anything. They don't occur in enormous numbers. So they don't do massive amounts of damage. And katydids are actually pretty omnivorous. They do feed on a lot of different types of plant foliage, but they're not averse to eating other insects either. So I guess they have a balance sheet with entries on both sides.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you. And if you're still listening,
yes.
I actually spent a wonderful summer in Vienna, Austria, right after I graduated from college. In order to improve my German, I stayed at Hochschule für Darstellende Kunst, I think it was called?
Hochschule für Darstellende Kunst.
Well, yeah.
It's still here. And
how about
still
that?
Alive and well. I sort of am the opposite. Having grown up in the States, when I get homesick, I try to get back to the central Illinois area for a visit. So.
Well, what I found out after 2 months in Austria, not so much my German improved, but my English deteriorated. So.
Well, I still hope that my English is up to specs. Thank you. So
thank
much.
You.
Well, thanks for the call. And just for those people who are interested in, indeed, the Carolina Biological Supply is at www.carolina.com. And here I'm looking at, we have 5 pages of models, which include such things as, well, here's a model of the head of the housefly. We also have a model of a flea. Let's see, they also had a model, I think it had a model of a cockroach head. For those of you,
I should get a wall in my house, you know, to put these.
Here's the head of the honeybee. There's also a grasshopper and an entire honeybee. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, Carolina Biological Supply, that's the place to go right there. Today's program brought to you in part by
great for holiday presents.
You bet. Let's go on here to, let's see, line number one. This is back here in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Sure, good.
When I was a kid growing up in Champaign, I used to see a lot and catch a lot of mantises. These days, I hardly ever see them. Do you know what's happened to them? Have they been killed off by pesticides?
Interesting that you should mention this, because one of my colleagues just the other day bemoaned the conspicuous absence of a lot of mantids. Very likely they are the unintended victims of agricultural practices where, you know, pesticides are applied, and generally they have a greater impact on the enemies of insects than they do on the target species themselves. One thing that might be happening, I don't know if the mantis you remember from childhood is the big, giant, green, 4-inch long one.
Well, I think that I had concluded looking at, you know, the little insect guide that I had at the time that it was something called Carolina mantis.
Oh, that's actually a native species.
It's smaller. It's not as big. It may be no bigger than maybe 3 inches long.
That's right. Yeah, that's a native species. So.
And they used to be everywhere. You know, I used to walk to school and find them on bushes, you know, the male, the brown male with the thin abdomen, and the green female, and sometimes brown female with a fatter abdomen and shorter wings.
That's right. It's entirely likely that two things: agriculture and its practices, and just plain development as well. There's just not as much in the way of natural areas anymore, or even agricultural areas. A lot of land has gone into development. Every time you take out the bottom of the food chain, you affect the top of the food chain even more. Most predators have like mantids, have a broader sort of foraging range. They'll forage in all different kinds of habitats in order to get enough to eat. But if you keep taking out the bottom part of the food chain by paving it and putting up a department store or something, then that's going to have impacts higher up. I don't know of any long-term population studies offhand, but I do know I have colleagues who've made exactly the same observation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. To Bye. Urbana next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. This is taking it further with your caller from Austria. I'm still not sure from your description of what I'm hearing now in the evenings, whether it's a cicada or a katydid. What I'm hearing is
Yeah, that's a cicada.
And
thank you for not making me do my insect impressions on air. One reason I didn't launch into an elaborate description here.
Okay.
But that sort of droning.
Yes,
that's
right.
Yeah, droning is cicadas. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and my next question is, I'm a composer, and I have written a piece, and I want to incorporate taped cicadas. And do you know of any source for that?
Actually, there are two potential sources. The Insectarium in Montreal, Canada, has a tape of insect sounds, and I'm pretty sure that there are cicadas on that tape. And there's also the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell University, name notwithstanding. They do recordings of all kinds of natural sounds.
Okay. Are you acquainted with an entomologist called Gall?
Larry Gall. Larry Gall?
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Apparently, in 1960, he made a whole album of insect sounds, which is I just learned this, which is available from Folkways Records. But I don't know whether it has cicadas on it. Do you know that album?
That album I don't know offhand, but I'm just about positive that the Insectarium tape does. I actually have a copy in my office. If I'd known, I could have brought it, but I didn't know we get this question. But
Insectarium?
Yeah. It's a remarkable place in Montreal. It's sort of a walk-in, just sort of celebration of insects. There are live insects there year-round.
That sounds, yeah. Okay, that sounds promising. Do you have an address?
I don't have one handy, but again, I see David.
Well, I'm going
online
see if I
here
can,
to see.
See if I can find
you just Montreal Insectarium should come up with.
I don't know. Maybe if I can find it by the end of the show, I would. I'll mention it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. The time I seem like I feel most aware of hearing katydids is at night, once the cicadas have gone to sleep. Do the katydids, are they singing all the time, or are they particularly singing, though, at night?
Again, I notice them when it's dark out, and cicadas right. will often start in at dusk or even earlier. You can hear them, you know, more around the clock than katydids. But katydids are pretty much dark of night singers, at least around here.
Okay. Well, we'll try and get into as many other folks as we possibly can here in the time that remains. Our next caller is in Peoria, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. During the war in 1943, I was in the jungles of New Guinea, and I got a moth that's 9.5-inch wingspan and a 5.5-inch yellow. It's a sort of a light brown, and we had tons of fire ants. That you couldn't even sleep. They'd fall on you and bite you as soon as they hit you.
Well, New Guinea is kind of a paradise for insect collectors, just not so much so they can get overwhelmed by nasty biting ants, but just the most spectacular insect diversity imaginable. And not just, you know, little insects, like you say, that might have been the atlas moth, which is one of the giant silk moths. They're enormous. They're like bigger than a small mouse.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let's go on here again. We'll have our next caller up on line number 3. That's Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Before I ask my question, I just want to second the recommendation for the insectarium in Montreal. I've been there. It's amazing.
I'm glad that someone who's not so deeply involved appreciates it, too.
And also I would recommend, I'm Canadian, so I'd recommend these heartily, but there's also the Butterfly Museum at Niagara Falls, which is very impressive as well. They keep it year-round. In the summer, they bring a lot of species from South America, and you just walk in, and they just land on you and flutter around. It's really incredible.
Actually, I was surprised in Calgary. The Calgary Zoo has a butterfly room, too, with butterflies from tropical places.
You wouldn't expect it in Canada.
Not in Calgary, anyway.
Okay.
So,
anyway, I have two questions. One, is, and I'll hang up and listen. One is there has there been a lot of research done on why certain people, including myself, seem to be more prone to mosquitoes and other types of biting insects? Is that just sort of cosmic bad luck, or is there anything that we can do about it? Because it doesn't seem to matter what I wear, unless I put on the equivalent of, you know, pure DDT, bright colors, dark colors, white. People can be sitting enjoying an evening with citronella candles burning all around, and I get bitten.
I'm of your tribe too. They would leave everybody else alone, but me, they would.
I'd be sitting there scratching invites while everyone else is saying, "What a pleasant evening."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. We could have a wall of citronella fire around us. And the other question is, and I tell this as a sort of horror story to my friends, but I've never actually known exactly what it was. One night when I was in Thailand, staying in a sort of bamboo hut on the beach, I woke up and there was about a, I would say, 4 to 5 inch red centipede on my leg. And of course, I went nuts. I was in my mosquito netting, thrashing around with a broom that I'd grabbed from the outside, just hoping that it wouldn't bite me, because I assumed that it would just be very bad news if it did. But I didn't ever actually find out what it was, what kind of centipede or anything. I'm assuming it was a centipede. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, in answer to the first question, that is the multi-thousand-dollar question, multi-million-dollar question, why some people are more attracted to biting insects than others. Personally, for me, it's fleas. They have a fatal attraction for me. They leap off cats onto me. And there's an enormous amount of work done, and a lot of it's proprietary. It's, you know, there are patents involved. There's a lab in Florida, used to be called the Insects Affecting Man and Livestock. I think they've kind of made it a snazzier name of late. But a fellow named Ulrich, I think his name is Bernier, B-E-R-N-I-E-R, apparently has hit upon at least one of the chemical attractants that varies from person to person that does affect susceptibility to mosquito bites, and he's now working on a way to block the receptor in the mosquito to produce chemicals that make this mosquito unable to protect this to detect this compound. What it is has not been published yet because he's got patents pending. Otherwise, what's known is lactic acid, which you sweat, carbon dioxide, which you breathe, and then this array of various fatty acid esters that can occur where there's bacterial decomposition, like between your toes, which is one of the reasons that a lot of mosquitoes seem to orient toward feet. And one alarming observation is many of these compounds are the same that you find in Limburger cheese. So if you want to maybe distract them, put out a big hunk of Limburger cheese and move away from it and watch what happens.
All right. Well, let's go here to another caller.
The centipede was the other one.
Ooh, eek. Creeps me out.
Yeah, I know we're running out of time here, but just briefly, most centipedes worldwide are not intensely toxic, but there are some exceptions, and they violate the usual rule where if it's really big, the venom is less likely to be nasty. True in scorpions. The bigger, scarier-looking the scorpion, the less toxic its venom is. The ones with really, really deadly venom tend to be sort of soft-bodied and small, and they need that extra kick for protection.
Okay, let's continue. And let's see, next caller is line number 3, and that would be in, next caller would be Indiana, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Last weekend we were over at Chautauqua National Wildlife Refuge, and we saw a painted lady butterfly which had a hairy back, very decided, you know, fuzzy back. Is that normal, or is it? I've never seen a butterfly like that before.
Hairy meaning?
I mean, long hairs on the back; they're noticeable.
And you know, you're sure it was a painted lady?
Yes.
Well. There are a lot of butterflies are hairy. Painted ladies aren't conspicuously hairy. The thing about painted ladies is that they can come from just about anywhere because they do have this migratory behavior. It might be that you were looking at a painted lady that actually had come from some part of the country north, and the hairy covering might be related to cooler temperatures during the larval period.
On the the abdomen, the torso. Where
right, yeah. So that's my only speculation. A lot of caterpillars are hairy, too. And, again, hairiness tends to be associated with cooler temperatures, variation in hairiness.
May I ask one other question?
Sure.
I've had some ants. They are so tiny. They're just like little bits of dust that they make up in, small size by the number of them. Do you happen to know what these small, tiny ants are?
Well, the tiniest ants are in the genus you find in houses are in the genus Monomorium. They're called the yellow ones are Faroe ants. The little black ones are called, believe it or not, little black ants, and they are extremely tiny. They're like a 1/12 of an inch in length, very small, just a couple of millimeters.
That small.
Yeah. So, and they are house pests. They're hard to get rid of, at least in part, because their small size means they can be just about anywhere.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry that we're going to have to stop. We've used our time, and we have some people we can't talk to. I'm sure on another day, Mae will come back, and we can do it again. And also, you might look for her books in the bookstore if you're interested in reading about insects. And for the person who's interested in the Insectarium in Montreal, I have a phone number for you. Area code 514-872-1400. They say it's the museum that everyone's buzzing about. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Mae Barenbaum, head of the Department of Entomology here at University of Illinois.